was to face the evil lurking out there.
"Trucks are coming,"
called a Canadian soldier from the lobby entrance. A convoy of vehicles drove toward the circle driveway outside the hotel.
"I gotta go, Kate," he said. "Be safe. I love you."
"I love you too."
He almost hung up, but then heard her speak again.
"Wait, Reed, are you there?"
"Yeah, I'm still here."
"When this is over, I was thinking, Javier could use a brother or a sister."
Beckham smiled. "Yeah, he'd like that. So would I."
"Then make sure you come home in one piece."
"That's an order, Captain." He smiled wider.
"I'll see you soon, my love."
She hung up, and Beckham handed the phone back to the Canadian officer who had lent it to him. Then he walked back to Team Ghost.
"How is everyone?"
Horn asked.
"Good. The kids are doing just fine."
"And Kate?"
"Okay."
"She doesn't want us to go, does she?"
Beckham shook his head.
"I don't blame her," Rico said. "You guys already put your time in."
"Yeah, well, things have changed," Beckham said.
"You guys can't get rid of us that easily. You're stuck with me and Bighorn now."
Fitz glanced over as he packed his ruck, but he didn't say anything. The team strapped on their packs and then huddled behind the big glass front door to the hotel. Snow fell in a blizzard-like torrent outside. Already, a foot of it had accumulated on the hotel grounds.
"God, I hate the cold."
Horn shoved his hands in his parka's pockets. Beckham wrapped a scarf around his face, then zipped his parka up to his chin. For the past few hours, they had rested and filled their stomachs, but there was one last thing to do before they once again parted ways. Honor Specialists Lincoln and Mendez.
"Everyone ready?"
asked Prince. He had been on the radio making sure security was tight for the ride that would take them to their planned stop before heading to the aircraft that would take them back to the States.
"Let's go," Fitz said.
He opened the doors and stepped outside, a gust of wind slamming into the team. Beckham tried to keep his scarf up, but the wind blew it loose, frigid air slicing through his beard. He pulled the scarf back up and followed Fitz down the stone steps to a convoy of three armored trucks and a white SUV with a brush guard. All the vehicles had chains over their tires. Team Ghost piled into the white SUV with Prince. The Canadian soldier behind the wheel drove down a road curving through the snow. With the sun hidden behind dark clouds and the relentless snowstorm, visibility was limited. Dohai had insisted they go somewhere where they had an expansive view of the mountains, lake, and forest surrounding them to say some final words for their fallen comrades. Prince said he knew just the place for a short ceremony, and it wasn't far from the runway. They might not be able to find a view because of the snowfall, but all the same, Beckham thought it was important they found a decent spot to pay their respects. Lincoln and Mendez deserved a proper burial, but like so many others who had died in the line of duty, that just wasn't possible. The Canadians were providing extra security for the ceremony and the takeoff, hence the three APCs driving along with them. The convoy drove over a road framed by 6-foot-high snowdrifts.
"Going to be twice as high by the time winter ends," Prince said.
A thick forest of pines appeared in the distance through the haze of snow. The mountains behind them cast a foreboding skyline. Jagged peaks lined the horizon like the teeth of a gigantic prehistoric animal.
"This is the turnoff," Prince said.
The driver followed the APCs. Through the screen of snow, Beckham could make out a lookout over a frozen lake. Picnic tables covered in snow protruded out of the drifts. Beckham imagined what this place was like in the past, when families came to enjoy a weekend or day in nature. But like most places in the world, this was now enemy territory. No one would eat a sandwich enjoying the view anytime soon, and that wasn't just because of the snow.
"Dohai, let's make this quick, okay?" Beckham said.
He didn't want to be insensitive, but he had to say what needed to be said. They couldn't afford to delay the mission or expose themselves to undue threats out here.
"Understood," Dohai said.
The team stepped out into the howling wind.
Canadian forces formed a perimeter around the picnic area with their rifles cradled. Prince remained close, but kept enough distance to give them some privacy. Dohai went to the edge of the lookout and bent down. He cleared a spot in the snow with a glove and then picked up some dirt. Beckham and Horn stood between Rico, Fitz, and Ace. They formed a half circle around Dohai. He rose to his feet and looked at the lake, then the mountains.
Before we part ways again, I wanted to spend a minute to honor the lives of Lincoln and Mendez, he said. My people are of a different faith, but we all share one very special thing. We come from the same place, and we return to the same place. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust, as my Christian brothers might say.
He crumbled the frozen chunks of dirt in his hands and let them fall to the ground.
Amen, Ace said. Today I pray that the souls of our brothers reach whatever afterlife they believed in, far from the demons that ail Mother Earth, Dohai said. And with the aid of Mother Earth and Father Sky and all of the holy people, I pray they find peace and sanctuary.
Dohai said something in Navajo, then fell into silence. When he finished, he performed a traditional ritual, pounding his chest, gesturing to the sky. Almost all of it was done in silence. Beckham bowed his head and prayed. A few minutes later, after dead silence, Dohai turned away from the mountains.
Thank you, Dohai, Beckham said. Anyone else want to say anything?
Fitz took a step out from the half circle.
Losing a brother or sister is what every leader fears. Mendez and Lincoln weren't just brave warriors. They were loyal friends who sacrificed their lives so we could keep fighting.
Beckham knew exactly how Fitz felt, having experienced it countless times.
And that's exactly what we are going to do, Fitz said,
then looked to the sky, snow piling at his blades.
Until the end, and until we meet again.
Damn right, Rico said.
Mendez and Lincoln were just kids, Ace said. I'll miss them breaking my balls and their jokes.
I got this gut feeling they're looking over us right now, Rico said.
Beckham brightened at the thought. He often felt his friends and loved ones were doing just that. Knowing they might still be watching out for him had gotten him through some very lonely, dark times. Prince walked over, his radio crackling.
Hate to interrupt, but we got an issue near the highway, he said. Two bears have been spotted.
You talking polar bears or some shit? Ace asked.
Prince shook his head.
Polar bears would be less of a threat. These bears are just the names we gave the alphas. These beasts have adapted to the snow and cold. They're as big as grizzlies, hairier, smarter, and a hell of a lot meaner.
Damn, Ace said.
Best to beat them to the aircraft, Prince said. You guys ready?
Yeah, Fitz said.
Beckham gave a nod. He looked at the mountains again, taking solace in the pristine view for one last moment. The snow, as bad as it was, gave it a decidedly peaceful look. He turned away and returned to the vehicles with the other soldiers. Once back in their seats, Dohai kept his head bowed and Ace wiped at his eyes. The drive to the highway only took 10 minutes. Three APCs were parked around the fuel tanker and two aircraft, soldiers encircling them for added protection. The C-130 was being de-iced, and a small single-prop plane was facing the opposite direction.
That's all right, Horn asked.
What do you want, a luxury jet? Rico asked.
That looks like a bush plane for a hunting trip, Horn said. This is a hunting trip, Beckham said.
Horn shook his head.
As long as it doesn't crash before it gets us out of this cold.
The whine of other, smaller motors growled over the highway. A group of Canadian soldiers on snowmobiles drove toward them. The soldiers on the snowmobiles had what looked like harpoon guns.
Okay, let's go,
Prince yelled over the chorus of different engines. Team Ghost got out of the SUV and huddled together, waiting to board. Fitz faced Beckham and held out a hand.
I guess this is goodbye again, said the younger soldier.
It's more like see you soon, Beckham replied.
He shook Fitz's hand and then pulled the man into a hug. As they embraced, Beckham said,
Honor the ones we've lost by fighting for the ones we can still save.
I will, Captain.
Fitz moved on to Horn, who picked the smaller man up in a bear hug.
Good luck, Big Horn,
Fitz wheezed.
You too, brother.
Rico went up to Fitz next. Beckham turned to give them some privacy. He adjusted the straps of his pack and rifle as he watched the snowmobiles at the edge of the road. There were two more in the distance, the engines rumbling faintly. Prince and Horn stepped up next to Beckham. A guttural growling came from the direction of the distant snowmobilers. The riders shot toward a beast barreling through the snow. Beckham had to use binoculars to see the creature. Already, two long harpoons stuck out of the furry bear-sized monster with a humanoid face. The snowmobilers chased it with a mesh net they held between each other. The creature flailed as the men trapped it. Several of the riders fired with rifles into the monster's flanks, but it still slashed at the net, forcing the snowmobilers to stop. One of the men hopped off and aimed his harpoon gun. He fired straight into the neck. The creature let out a monstrous roar, damn near loud enough to cause an avalanche.
Ugly bastard was trying to sneak up on us, Prince said.
Man, I really, really do not like it here. No offense, Horn said, shivering.
None taken.
Didn't you say there were two? Ace asked.
Yeah, so that's another reason to get moving, eh? Prince said.
Fitz and Rico had parted, and she walked over to Beckham and Horn.
Ready to board? She asked.
Beckham finally said goodbye to Dohai and Ace before they departed. Fitz followed the two larger men to the C-130, looking back over his shoulder, his eyes glued on Rico.
See you soon,
Fitz called out. Beckham watched what was left of Team Ghost split to take separate paths. For the second time that day, he prayed they would all see each other again. 15. The roar of the engines rumbled through Dohai. Once again, Ghost was about to be dropped into enemy territory. The team was smaller than ever, with the devastating loss of Mendez and Rico taking off on another leg of the mission with Beckham and Horn. Dohai felt an overwhelming sense of loneliness, especially poignant in the huge empty belly of the C-130, even with Fitz and Ace nearby. Fitz rested his chin against his chest as he tried to grab a few moments of sleep. Ace had his arms folded, head back against the bulkhead. His eyes were closed, and Dohai could hear him snoring over the engines. Besides the crew chiefs, it was just the three operators. The huge airplane seemed like overkill for the small group, when so many people were still needing evac back at the outposts. In the center of the plane was a rigid-hulled inflatable buoyancy rib boat that the Canadian forces had lent them for their incursion into Seattle. Kamer had seemed proud to offer it to them, but to Dohai, it was just another reminder of the minimal support their neighbors in the north were offering. This was supposed to be a stealth mission, perfectly suited for Dohai's unique abilities. He was anxious to find the Center for Engineering Complex Organs, assuming it still existed. If it did, then their mission would morph into one of intel grabbing. They would scout out the premises and identify any leaders involved with the attacks on the Allied states, determining if the enigmatic master called this place home. To Dohai, the plan was like shooting an arrow in the dark and hoping it hit something. But with no other leads, this was the only shot they could take. Fitz looked up, blinking away his sleep. Dohai saw the worry in his eyes now that Rico had gone off with Beckham and Horn. He tried to think of something to say, but he couldn't come up with any reassuring words that seemed appropriate. All he could manage was,
How are you doing, brother?
I'm okay, Fitz said.
You?
Ready for whatever comes next.
You think this could really lead to something, though?
If we can find evidence of CECO's involvement with the Chimeras and all these recent attacks, yeah, I do,
Fitz said.
We bring that kind of intel back, and I have a feeling the Canadians will join this fight. Kammer already knows about the collaborators and the losses we've taken. Why would this mission change his mind? All they've seen are the normal hordes of variants and those bears. This war must seem like another world to them, and they probably don't believe it's as bad or organized as we say it is. They'll think differently when the Chimeras are in their backyard with an army of variants, too. By then, it'll be too late. Fitz paused. For all of us.
One of the crew chiefs near the rear ramp spoke over the open comms.
We're approaching the drop zone, he said. Get ready.
Ace woke with a start, grumbling and checking over his suppressed M4A1. He stood and checked the straps on his chute. Dohai and Fitz made their final preparations.
5 minutes, said the crew chief.
He hit a button, activating a sling that dragged the rib on its drop platform toward the rear ramp. Dohai slipped on his chute. Using the handholds hanging overhead, he waddled toward the rear of the plane with Fitz and Ace, each holding their gear.
Back into the belly of the beast, Ace said.
The crew chief hit the lever to lower the rear ramp. Howling wind filled the fuselage. Cold air tugged at Dohai, despite the thermal underwear and ACUs he wore under his dry suit. Leaning forward slightly, he peered over the open ramp. Beneath them lay a thick carpet of gray. By now, they should be somewhere over the Puget Sound, but he couldn't see the water nor the islands dotting the vast body of water through the fog. Their ultimate destination was Seattle. Toward the southeast, it was also concealed by haze.
We're almost over Marrowstone Island, said the crew chief. That's going to be your drop zone and your rendezvous point. Remember, this is low altitude, so pull those chutes right away.
Fitz dipped his helmet. A few pangs of sunlight shone behind the fog, making it grow a slightly lighter shade. Team Ghost didn't usually execute missions in the daylight, but this fog provided better cover than even the dark of night. The normally nocturnal variants would be lying low, and any Chimeras, collaborators, or other hostile contacts would suffer from the low visibility that even NVGs or thermal imaging couldn't pierce.
Deploy the drogue, shouted the crew chief at the rear ramp.
Two other crew chiefs pushed the rib and its platform onto the rear ramp. The olive-green drogue parachute burst from the back of the platform and caught in the wind. It dragged behind the plane, pulling the rib to the end of the rear ramp.
As soon as the boat drops, you boys are next, the crew chief said. Wait for my signal.
Dohai felt the tingle of electricity coursing through his veins. With all the fog, he could barely see 30 feet around the plane, much less the ground and water below. He had to trust the pilots, their instruments, and his own wrist-mounted altimeter that they were being dropped at the right place.
Father Sky, look out for us, he prayed. And Mendez, if you're watching, this one's for you, brother.
Rib out, the crew chief said, hitting another button.
The drogue chute yanked the rib and platform out into the fog. A second later, the set of five parachutes secured on the rib exploded outward, big canvas domes catching in the wind. The launching platform separated from the boat and plummeted, its drogue parachute twirling away into the fog.
Go, 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 the crew chief shouted.
Ace hurtled out of the plane, followed by Fitz. The gray fog swallowed them and the rib. Dohai flipped down his night vision goggles and leapt into the abyss. He spread his arms and legs out to control his descent, letting the air batter his body for a few seconds while he maintained an arch position. Twisting his wrist, he checked his altimeter. Then he pulled the strap on his chute. It burst open, his body whipped forward by momentum. As the canopy lowered him, he tracked his descent with the altimeter. The NVGs couldn't see through the fog at what awaited him below, but they did let him see the white glowing blink of the infrared tags on Fitz and Ace's NVGs refracting through the mist. It took him a few seconds to locate them drifting beneath his location. Another couple hundred feet beneath the operators was the rib, with its own IR tags flashing around its gunwale. Dohai toggled over, following the others, just a few dozen feet above them. A loud splash sounded over his rippling chute. He presumed it belonged to the boat hitting the water. Another few seconds later, and he hit the cold water.
Dohai cut off his chute and paddled toward the IR signature from the rib. Silver waves crashed over him as he swam, finding the gaps around his neck in the dry suit. By the time he drew close enough to see the rib, Ace and Fitz were already aboard and had the motor started. Fitz reached down to help Dohai climb into the craft. Ace cruised away, plowing through the fog at half throttle to reduce their noise. The nearly two-hour-long trip was spent in relative silence. Ace occasionally glanced at a handheld GPS to navigate. As they continued their journey, the fog lifted enough that they no longer relied purely on the device. Dohai flipped up his NVGs to the gray-green of the rising bulk of islands. To the southeast, the looming shapes of Seattle started to coalesce.
Almost there, Fitz said. Dohai, keep an eye out for a good place to pull in. I think...
He never completed the sentence. A monstrous creature burst from the stormy water's surface and landed in the boat. Water sluiced off a variant with webbed feet and hands. The beast roared and slashed at Ace. The big operator fell back against the gunwale. Dohai reached for his hatchet, ready to cleave off the creature's grotesque face, but it lunged first, slamming into his chest. He tumbled over the gunwale and into the water. The freezing cold stung his face as he tried to see through the murk, panic swelling through his chest. He clawed his way back up to the surface, but before he could gasp for breath, something sharp tightened on his ankle, yanking his foot down. He twisted his neck enough to see a sinewy arm stretch from the darkness. The variant's claws had wrapped around his boot. Dohai struggled, the weight of his gear and the monster's strength pulling him deeper. With gills, it didn't need to kill him with claws. All it had to do was hold him under until he stopped breathing. Then it would tear him apart and feed. But the beast didn't seem patient enough for that. Instead, it maneuvered around him using its webbed hands to shoot through the water. Even with the silt obscuring his vision, Dohai saw a mouthful of jagged teeth. His muscles started to burn, desperate for oxygen. The monster bit at his face, and Dohai did all he could to try and keep away from the maw. Over and over it snapped as it pulled him down. Through his panicked brain, he tried to free himself from the strong grip. He and the monster became a tangled mess of limbs and claws. He reached for his knife, finally slipping the blade out of its sheath. With the weapon in hand, he stabbed at the ribs of the monster. Dark clouds of blood punched out of the wounds. But the lack of oxygen had taken its toll. Dohai's muscles began to lock. Another stab and the creature pulled back, bubbles streaming from its mouth as it let out a muffled roar. More blood mixed with the silt as the variant thrashed. The glint of metal flashed through the water, cutting across the beast's gills. Letting out a gurgle, the creature went listless, sinking. Dohai's consciousness started to fade, just as hands grabbed him, pulling him again, this time toward the surface. He broke through a moment later, sucking in the frigid air. Fitz surfaced next to him, also gasping. Ace reached over the gunwale of the rib and dragged them both on board. Then he returned to the motor and sped away, faster this time, in case more variants were skimming underwater after them. Dohai lay on his back, still heaving. His muscles were tingling, but his head no longer pulsed from oxygen deprivation.
Thank you, he managed to say. Thank you for saving me.
Fitz patted him on the shoulder and turned as Ace took them closer to shore. They would have more cover there and could find somewhere to stash the boat while they continued on foot. Ace finally found shelter for the boat near Smith Cove Park, just north of downtown Seattle. As they pulled in, the sun emerged, providing a clear view of the city.
Holy shit, Ace bellowed.
Dohai lifted his binos to his eyes, taking a minute to soak it all in. Piles of rubble along the harbor where abandoned ships and boats had rammed together formed a monstrous island of flotsam. Farther inland, half the skyscrapers were nothing but blackened husks burned out from past fires. The iconic Space Needle reached like a finger toward the gray sky, half its saucer-shaped observation deck gone. But it wasn't the destruction of the city's skyline that had caused Ace's reaction. Vines hung from the tip of the Space Needle down to the park around it and other neighboring buildings. Dohai saw specks moving on those vines, which he assumed were variants. Dohai passed the binoculars off to Fitz.
If we don't find the real master here, then God help us, he said.
Dohai recalled his original fear going on this mission. They might have shot an arrow in the dark, but the arrow had hit a target. The question now was whether they could handle what they discovered in this new hell. President Ringgold entered the lab at the Long Island bunker with a backpack over her shoulder. The four Secret Service agents shadowing her waited outside with her chief of staff, James Soprano. None of them were happy with her decisions, but she wasn't out to make them happy. Inside the laboratory, she found Kate and Sammy helping their assistants Ron and Leslie load the rest of their gear. Are you all ready to head out? Ringgold asked. Sammy turned in her direction, wincing in pain. Are you good? Ringgold said.
Yes, we've integrated all of the unprocessed natural language signals we derived from the variance communications, and Sammy started to explain.
I mean, do you feel okay? Ringgold asked. Oh, Sammy said, embarrassed.
Yes, I'm okay.
Kate smiled.
We're ready, Madam President.
The doctor's tone was confident and helped reassure Ringgold. Good. The helicopter is waiting for us, she said.
What do you mean, us? Kate asked, confused.
I'm coming with.
Is it safe?
Ron asked timidly.
If it's safe enough for all of you, it's safe enough for me, Ringgold said. Ma'am, the people there are going to go nuts when they see you, Sammy said.
She means that in a good way, Leslie clarified.
I guess we'll find out soon, Ringgold said.
As they exited the lab together, the agents and Soprano surrounded their small group and escorted them outside the bunker. The cold afternoon wind greeted them on the walk to the helipad. Marine One waited, engines already fired up, and Marines had already formed a perimeter around the bird. Ringgold saluted the Marine guarding the chopper. She climbed into the cabin with Soprano taking a seat next to her. The science team and her four Secret Service agents all piled in next. The crew chief closed the door to seal out the cold, and Ringgold relaxed in the leather seat as the cabin filled with warm air. The pilots wasted no time getting them airborne. Ringgold spent the ride to Lower Manhattan discussing Kate and Sammy's plans for the tunnels, along with the unfolding implications of the sites in Seattle and Denver that Team Ghost was investigating. She knew the country's situation was dire, but now they had a real lead on who their enemy was and where that enemy was likely hiding. Before, it seemed like they had been shipwrecked, flailing to stay afloat in rough seas. But now she saw the shoreline on the horizon. A pilot's voice interrupted their conversations.
We're approaching Lower Manhattan. Prepare for landing.
Long columns of dark smoke snaked up across the city from the battle that had gone through the night. Embers smoldered where towers had collapsed, and dark, oily water flooded the streets around the crumbling remains of City Hall. Never in her long tenure of public service had she expected the horror that had gripped her people like it had over these past few weeks. The only sight that gave her hope was the Statue of Liberty, still intact, the eternal flame burning on her torch. She took a mental photograph of that image, stashing it into her memory. The statue represented the ideals they were fighting for, the ideals she knew they would realize again.
Beginning our descent now, the pilot said over the intercom.
The chopper swooped between the skyscrapers, avoiding the remnants of scaffolding and frames that stuck out like busted bones breaking through flesh. They lowered to the LZ and hit the ground with a soft thud. A cold breeze swam through the cabin after the crew chief opened the door. The four Secret Service agents hopped out first. One ducked and beckoned for Ringgold and Soprano.
It's clear, he said.
Ringgold let the science team exit first, then followed behind them, Soprano following her. She took the first steps out of the chopper, the rotor wash from the winding down blades kicking up her hair. With one hand, she shielded her eyes from the midday sun as her pupils adjusted. After she brought her hand back down, she was greeted with a welcoming party led by a woman with red hair. She had the straight poise of a seasoned commanding officer. A handful of other military officers in uniform stood alongside her. The female commander snapped into a brisk salute.
Madam President,
Welcome to Outpost Lower Manhattan.
Ringgold saluted back.
Thank you, she said. Good to be with you. I'm Commander Amber Massey, and... well, it's an honor to meet you.
She broke from formalities and extended her hand. Ringgold exchanged greetings with Massey and the other military officers, and the civilians who had come to introduce themselves to her as well. She was prepared to be bombarded with demanding questions and perhaps angry words, but the faces around her seemed grateful.
Thank you all for the warm welcome, Ringgold said. I want to talk more with each of you to see how we can help, but first, Dr. Lovato and her team need to get to the tunnels to begin their work. Of course, we're finishing our final security sweeps, Massey said. In the meantime, we can help you prepare your equipment and suit up.
She turned to a thin man in olive fatigues.
Dodlin, can you show them the new staging tent?
Yes, ma'am, he replied. Dr. Lovato, please follow me.
Kate and her team followed the soldier toward a tent set among the white oak trees lined in rows around the outpost. Ringgold and Soprano stayed with Massey as the crowd dispersed.
James, I want you to start meeting with officers in the command center, Ringgold said. We should go over aid shipment logistics and evacuation rates.
Yes, ma'am, Soprano said.
Another soldier stepped up to guide the chief of staff into the outpost.
Where would you like to go first, ma'am? Massey asked Ringgold.
I'd like to visit your medical facility.
Massey's brow furrowed at that request, and she paused.
That bad? Ringgold asked. There are some horrific injuries, Madam President.
These were the people who had been willing to sacrifice their lives to protect this country. As their leader, she figured she ought to understand what she had asked of them in defending outposts like this.
I'm prepared, she said.
Massey led Ringgold toward the museum at the 9/11 memorial. Ringgold noticed people around the base pause their work, looking toward her as they passed. She saw a few whisper to each other, as if they didn't quite believe the president was on the ground in their midst. The Secret Service agents followed closely, scanning the civilians and soldiers. She couldn't help but wonder if any were collaborators. A soldier held open the door to the museum. Immediately, the smell of antiseptics hit her. The moans and whimpers of the injured filled the first room she entered. Medics, doctors, and nurses treated patients wrapped in bandages laying on cots set up in rows along the museum floor. Ringgold went to the first cot she saw. A Hispanic woman in her 30s lay in the cot. Bandages covered her chest and left arm.
Is it really you?
The woman started to ask, squinting. Ringgold offered a warm smile and knelt by the woman, placing a hand on her uninjured shoulder.
I'm with you, she said. And it's an honor to be next to someone as brave as you.
The woman's eyes focused.
My brother died to help save this place from the monsters we were told were gone.
Ringgold had prepared for this.
I'm so sorry, she said. We're doing everything we can.
The woman turned away, and Ringgold stepped back, sighing. Determined to continue, she went between the cots, shaking hands and listening to the stories of the injured. Some doled out criticism, others praise. Regardless of what they said to her, she thanked each and every one of them. She made no excuses for underestimating the power of the variants and didn't make empty promises to them. Soprano would have cautioned her about what she should say to these people. Sure, this might be political suicide to confront the truth like this, but politics didn't matter anymore. Her goal was to simply show her people she was there for them, that she would always be there for them, and that she was one of them.
We have more people waiting outside, Massey said, after Ringgold had visited nearly everyone in the museum.
They went back to the memorials. The sun had since vanished behind dark, rolling storm clouds. A cold sprinkle fell over them as she greeted more outpost civilians.
Ma'am, we'd better find shelter, said one of her agents. The storm looks like it's getting worse.
Massey directed Ringgold to a wide canvas tent. Inside were a few tables that were laid out with maps and computers. Nearly 20 soldiers and officers were hard at work, Soprano among them. Thunder boomed outside, making most of the people look up.
It looks like I brought the bad weather with me today, Ringgold said.
At least you're here, Massey said. Your presence is going to help motivate people and reassure them we can get through another attack.
She paused, looking concerned. But I've got to be honest.
Ringgold steeled herself.
We can't take much more, Massey said coldly. What you saw today is all we have left.
16.
You sure you can sail? Ruckley asked. She sat in the back of the mail truck parked in the post office garage. The color had returned to her face, and her fever had broken. In just half a day, she had perked up. The antibiotics had worked. Now that her wound dressings were clean again, they were ready to continue toward Boston.
My dad taught me how to sail, Timothy said. Our biggest problem today is going to be whether the boat is in good shape. Sailboats don't do well if they're neglected. If we can find a good boat, then we'll just have to hope we're not spotted on the way to Boston. Variants can swim, you know.
Yeah, and they run fast, too.
Fast.
Wherever we go, they're out there.
But how many are really going to be out in the ocean when there's plenty of available food on land right now?
She shrugged.
I guess it depends on if they want surf or turf for dinner.
Timothy smiled.
All I know is I don't plan on sticking around here until they make us dinner. I just want to get to Boston, radio command, and blow Mount Katahdin sky high before the collaborators do any more damage.
Sounds like a plan, kid.
He finished packing the rest of their gear. They had discarded some things they didn't need so they could move faster, keeping just the necessities like medicine, food, water, extra ammo, and warm clothing. He had also cleaned their rifles.
The river is only about a mile away, he said. You ready?
She jammed a magazine into her rifle and chambered the first round.
Lead the way.
Timothy opened the garage's back door, did a scan of the parking lot, and then walked out into the cold evening. With only a few hours of light left, he wanted to move fast and launch the sailboat as quickly as possible. If all went to plan, they would be in Boston by morning. But it looked like that would have to happen in the rain. Ominous storm clouds loomed from the east, rolling their direction and releasing the first sprinkles that splattered on Timothy's coat. By the time they had made it just a block, the sky opened up, dropping water on them by the bucketful.
Just our luck, he thought.
He could endure the cold rain, but Ruckley wasn't in the clear yet. Her immune system was probably still weak from the infection, and coming down with pneumonia wouldn't do her any favors. If Ruckley was uncomfortable, she didn't show it. She walked fast, not far behind him, eyes ahead, and scanning for hostiles. They pushed on for a good 15 minutes, clearing street after street in the rain. Eventually, he spotted the bridge over the river. But this time, it wasn't empty. A black SUV was parked in the middle. He didn't remember it being there before. He motioned to stop. Then he snuck behind the cover of a wide tree trunk in a front lawn. Ruckley took shelter behind an adjacent tree.
What's wrong? She whispered.
I didn't see that SUV on the bridge earlier, he said quietly. He went prone and pressed the scope of his rifle to his eye. Rain pattered his body as he lay under the leafless branches and zoomed in on the bridge. Rust covered the SUV's wheel wells, but otherwise it looked to be in good condition. The tires were aired and the windshield and windows were all intact. They were tinted, preventing him from seeing inside. He glanced the rest of the bridge and its vicinity, but saw nothing to indicate suspicious activity besides the new vehicle.
Screw the boat, he whispered to Ruckley. Maybe we can get a good car.
She put a finger to her mouth, and Timothy soon understood why. A second vehicle rumbled toward the bridge, this one a pickup. Unlike the black SUV, he saw men in the front cab, and more in the bed. Way too many to risk opening fire. But if they were collaborators. Timothy zoomed in to see if he recognized them, but none looked familiar.
Maybe they're friendlies, he said. Or maybe they heard your motorcycle earlier. They could be looking for us.
A deep chill ran through Timothy. He centered his crosshairs on a figure in camo.
Wait until they leave, Ruckley said.
Timothy nodded. 20 minutes passed. The men stood on the bridge as puddles formed around them.
Timothy wondered if they were waiting there to stop someone or something. Another 40 minutes went by, cold water puddling around Timothy. It soaked his clothes and turned the overgrown lawn into a muddy mess. His feet went numb, and he wiggled his toes to keep the blood flowing. Ruckley had hardly moved, but her face had drained of color. She was shivering. He prayed she wasn't getting sick again. He doubted her body could take another viral thrashing. They had to get out of the rain.
"Maybe we should go back,"
he started to say. She shook her head. Another 10 minutes ticked by until they heard the thump of a helicopter. Timothy tilted his head to the gray sky. The noise came from the northeast. He spotted the chopper that seemed to be headed southwest toward Boston. An engine roared to life on the bridge. Loud voices called to one another as the men pointed at the incoming bird. Timothy could now see it was a Chinook. The man in the camo climbed back into the pickup's bed.
"Now's our chance," Ruckley said. "Get ready to move."
Timothy pushed at the ground, his freezing muscles numb. As he stood, the men still on the bridge spread out, crouching, rifles aimed at the sky. The man wearing camo pulled a Law rocket from the truck bed. He too directed the weapon toward the clouds.
"Shit," Ruckley said.
Shit was right, Timothy thought. These guys were trying to take out the chopper. They must have been collaborators after all. The black SUV peeled away and suddenly came tearing down the road as the Chinook grew closer. Maybe the bird was carrying evacuees to safety or hauling reinforcements to bolster an outpost's defenses. A rocket streaked away from the Law launcher. The pilots didn't even have a chance to maneuver. The rocket slammed into the Chinook's belly, exploding on impact. Fire and smoke bloomed around the bottom of the big bird. Gunfire erupted from the Chinook, tearing into the pickup truck. While he and Ruckley had refrained from blowing their position before, now the stakes had just gotten higher. She gave the order to fire. Timothy aimed at the guy with the rocket and pulled the trigger. The top of the man's skull exploded in a spray of red. The other three men looked around, confused. Ruckley squeezed off a burst into the midsection of one man. Timothy took out another with two bullets to the stomach. The third man ran but didn't make it far. The pickup suddenly exploded, and the resulting inferno swallowed the running man. That left only the SUV. The driver did a U-turn and sped away. Timothy fired a few shots, but then decided to conserve his precious ammunition. He turned to watch the distressed Chinook. The pilots somehow had managed to stay in the air so far. Smoke billowed away from the fuselage, but a second fire erupted from its engines, and the tail rotor stopped working, putting the bird into a tailspin. Timothy and Ruckley watched it pass overhead as it spun wildly.
"Down!"
she shouted. They both ducked down as it rammed into a riverside mansion, exploding into a blinding burst. Timothy shielded his face with a hand, and a wave of heat rolled over him as he hugged the mud. For a moment, he just stared in shock, until Ruckley grabbed his shoulder.
"Get to that boat before the SUV comes back," she said.
Timothy jogged down the riverbank as flames licked the sky. Dark, oily smoke drifted away from the crash site. No one could have survived that crash. And Timothy felt a pang of regret that they hadn't acted sooner to stop that man with the rocket launcher. But all he could do now was focus on getting out of here. As soon as they got to the sailboat, he untethered it and then started raising the sails. Ruckley followed his instructions, and in a few minutes the sails filled with wind from the dissipating storm, carrying them down the river. The small white craft sailed past the burning wreckage on the shoreline. The charcoaled cockpit of the Chinook was visible, sticking out of a collapsed brick wall of the house it had slammed into. Once they hit the ocean, Timothy never looked back, focused only on steering the boat. If the brief battle was any indication of what this night had in store for them, he wondered what Boston would be like when they pulled into port, assuming they even made it. The pilot of the single-prop plane was a Canadian man named Liam Tremblay. He had spent most of the long flight asking Beckham what was happening in the Allied States and telling him a bit about the cancer that was slowly killing him. Before they even took off, he had warned them he was sick, which explained why he was so thin and gaunt. While Liam hadn't said how advanced it was, he assured the team he could pilot the plane.
Flying into enemy territory while suffering from tragic disease told Beckham all he needed to know about Liam's character. The man wasn't just brave, he was a determined and caring soul, despite the dire circumstances. In the back seats, Horn and Rico were sleeping hard. Beckham had stayed awake to keep Liam company. He had always wondered what their northern neighbors thought of the Allied States. After all, the United States military had created the monsters now plaguing the world. Surprisingly, Liam didn't hold a grudge.
If it wasn't variants, it would have been another virus or something that nature cooked up, he said. Maybe even an asteroid or supervolcano. Or aliens, eh?
Not sure about the aliens, but I get your point, Beckham said.
To be honest, most Canadians don't feel the same. They blame your government and are skeptical about helping your new government. Took a while to even find someone willing to take you guys back to the States. But I volunteered when I heard about the mission.
Beckham realized now why they were flying in a bush plane with a guy dying of cancer. The Canadians must have thought this was a suicide mission. They didn't mind sending a guy who was not only willing to take on this assignment, but also might not have much time left on this earth. He had hoped General Kamer would reconsider how much he was willing to help the Allied States, but this confirmed the reality of the situation. Kamer had a long road ahead of him before he would be convinced.
Looks like we just cleared Montana, Liam said. We're in Wyoming now.
Beckham leaned to see out the side window, but there was too much thick cloud cover to make out anything below. Their destination was an abandoned Air Force base in Cheyenne. Once they landed, they would switch to a helicopter that command had sent along with a team of recon Marines. Their next destination would be Denver.
I still don't understand how the variants could have gone undetected for so long, Liam said. I thought you all were watching the border.
We were, but the beasts were mostly underground. North America is a big continent, especially when your military is a fraction of the size it used to be, and you don't have all the resources you used to. Even more importantly, the variants had human help. Collaborators were planning this attack for 8 years.
Human collaborators?
Yes.
Liam sighed and shook his head, but his focus seemed to drift from the conversation. He grimaced and then took a drink from his thermos. The plane shook, and raindrops pattered the windshield.
Going to try and take us under this, Liam said. Hold on.
Beckham watched as Liam punched a few controls. Then the pilot maneuvered to start a descent that lasted a few minutes. The plane shuddered the entire way before evening out. Liam started their conversation off from where he'd left it.
But you can stop them, right? The variants and their human allies? There's no way they can take over the Allied States, destroy all your outposts, and then march north, eh?
It was amazing to Beckham that their neighbors didn't realize the full brunt of what was happening to the South. Then again, it had happened so fast, sometimes even the people in the States had trouble wrapping their minds around it.
We'll stop them, Rico said from the back seat.
She was sitting up now. Horn was awake too, scratching his unkempt, long red beard. The plane trembled again from another pocket of turbulence.
Are we almost there?
Horn asked, looking out the window with wild eyes.
I can't stand much more of this shit.
About 45 minutes to go, Liam replied. The Marines should already be on the ground unless they're late too.
Nah, the devil dogs are never late,
Horn said. Beckham was glad to be linking up with the Marines. He was always honored to fight with the warriors.
Beginning our descent, Liam said.
The plane vibrated violently as he flew lower through the thick clouds. A few agonizing minutes later, the nose broke through the gray screen. Beckham got his first look of the Wyoming city where they were headed. Empty roads wound between buildings, not a moving vehicle in sight.
Prepare for landing, Liam said.
The plane dropped lower to the brown terrain, and now Beckham saw a more detailed picture of this city. Nature had regained control. Weeds and overgrown prairie grass sprouted over lawns and covered parks. To the east, a few blocks of houses and buildings were burned to their foundations. It took him a moment to realize their LZ was in the middle of the charred wreckage. The wheels lowered toward an airstrip at the Air Force base, now nothing but a few buildings standing amid a sea of rubble and flattened hangars.
Touching down,
Liam said. The plane bounced slightly when it hit the airstrip as Liam fought against a choppy side wind. As they slowed, Beckham searched for the Marine recon team and their chopper.
"Anyone see him?" he asked.
"There they are," Rico said, pointing. Beckham twisted and followed her finger toward a mountain of rubble. A stealth Blackhawk sat nearby. Liam directed the small plane toward the bird. When they reached it, he killed the engine and leaned over.
"Best of luck on your mission," the grizzled pilot said. "Thanks for the lift," Beckham said, reaching over to shake Liam's hand. "It was great to meet you, my friend."
"Yeah, it wasn't as bad as I thought," Horn said. "I didn't throw up."
Liam chuckled.
"Good, because then I'd have to charge you for cleanup."
The team and Liam hopped out into the cloudy, cold afternoon. Beckham cradled his rifle, looking around the base. A breeze rippled his fatigues. He started toward the Blackhawk. Rico picked up her bag and started off for the bird, but Beckham held out his prosthetic hand.
"Hold on," he said. "Where the hell is everyone?"
Something was off. The Marines and pilots were nowhere in sight. While Beckham wasn't expecting a welcome party, he thought they would be greeted with more than stone-cold silence.
"Get down!"
an unfamiliar voice shouted. Rifle fire cracked through the air, and Beckham's prosthetic leg kicked out from under him. He hit the pavement hard on his side. At that angle, he spotted a Marine in a prone position on the other side of the Blackhawk. The man was gesturing for Beckham to take cover. Horn pulled Beckham back behind the plane where Rico and Liam had already taken cover. Another round split the air, and a bullet lanced into the engine, oil spilling out.
"Son of a bitch," Liam said. "Where the hell is that coming from?"
Beckham looked down at his shattered prosthetic. The bullet had blown off the bottom half. It definitely had to be a high-caliber rifle. Another one punched into the plane with a crack. Liam cursed.
"Where is he?"
12 o'clock, on the roof of that radio building," Horn said. "Cover me and I'll distract him."
"I'm faster," Rico said. "Let me do this." Beckham pushed his rifle scope up and zoomed in on the building. He couldn't see the sniper, but he could see the rooftop.
"Okay," he said. "Rico, you go."
"You head left and I'll blow this fucker's head off," Horn said.
"I've got you too, Rico," Beckham said.
She crept toward the tail of the plane as Horn counted. On three, she took off running. A shape pushed up over the lip of the roof, and Beckham fired a concerted burst. Horn let loose a spray of bullets from his saw. A cloud of red mist exploded upward. Beckham lowered his rifle and searched for Rico. She made it behind a concrete barrier. Relieved, he looked back through the scope and waited for another shot.
"Contact!"
Horn shouted.
"Friendly!"
someone yelled back. Horn aimed at a Marine gripping his shoulder, blood soaking through his fatigues. Beckham hopped, and Liam reached out to help him amble over to the Marine. He was short, with a 5 o'clock shadow, brown eyes, and a cleft chin. Maybe 25 or 30 years old.
"Damn good to see you," he said, his voice wheezing. "I'm Sergeant A.G. Parnell." "Any more snipers out there?"
Horn asked. Parnell shook his head.
"That was the last one."
"Where's the rest of your team?" Beckham asked.
The young man looked down.
"I'm it."
"I'm sorry," Beckham said.
Liam helped Beckham sit on a pile of rubble. As soon as he did, Beckham felt the deep dread of the pointless loss. The men who had been willing to risk their lives, hardened warriors, had been cut down before the mission even got off the ground.
"About an hour after we landed, 3 snipers opened fire. Must have seen us or heard us when we flew in," Parnell explained. "We took cover behind that rubble. We got 2, but they flanked us and took out everyone but me. That guy had me pinned. Couldn't even stick out my head without him cracking shots."
"Rico, Horn, go make sure the snipers are actually dead," Beckham said.
"You got it,"
Horn said, already running off with his saw. Rico stayed close behind him.
"I'm going to check the plane," Liam said. "One of those shots hit the engine."
"Bring us a field kit, please," Beckham said.
Liam left Beckham seated on the rubble and returned with the kit before heading back to check the plane. Beckham looked at Parnell's wound. The top of his shoulder was a bloody mess. The Marine was definitely not in fighting condition.
Have a seat so I can help, Beckham said.
I'm fine,
Parnell said. Bullshit, Sergeant, sit down. Parnell finally complied, and Beckham went to work.
Honestly, I'm surprised you can still stand, Beckham said. How bad's the pain? Do you need anything for it?
Parnell shook his head.
Hardy took what we had in our field kits. The pain's barely a dull throbbing.
You're gonna want more when that wears off.
He applied antibiotic gel and wrapped the wound in quick clotting combat gauze. By the time he finished, Horn and Rico had jogged over.
Dead? Beckham asked.
Dead as rocks, Horn said.
Were they collaborators? Rico asked.
Not sure,
Horn said.
They didn't have radios, and I didn't see evidence of variant activity nearby, like that nasty red webbing stuff. These guys might have just been some desperate bandits.
Bandits who knew how to shoot, Parnell said, grimacing. I still don't... His words trailed as he looked out over the airstrip where his brothers were dead.
Can you bring them here? Parnell asked. I don't want them out there, just rotting.
Yeah, man,
Horn said, ruefully. He walked off to retrieve the bodies with Rico. Liam returned from examining his plane and let out a long sigh.
The plane is done. I had a feeling this was a one-way ticket.
Not necessarily.
Oh?
Can you fly a chopper? Beckham asked.
Liam shrugged.
I haven't for years.
Well, you're gonna have to try.
Rico helped Horn finish dragging over the bodies of the Marines. Together, they laid the men beside the chopper and covered them with jackets. Parnell went over and knelt, whispering prayers under his breath. On both flanks, Beckham was joined by Rico and Horn.
We gotta get going, Rico said quietly. No time to bury them.
Bring them with, Beckham said.
They started to load the bodies while Beckham searched the troop hold, trying to figure out how he could carry out this mission with his busted prosthetic leg. There were crates of gear, including CBRN suits and masks to protect against the radiation in Denver, but he didn't see anything to fix his busted prosthetic. Nothing in there could help him walk, let alone run if he had to. Parnell watched Horn and Rico carry the last of the bodies into the troop hold.
I'm sorry, brother, Beckham said.
Parnell nodded and wiped at his face with his bandaged shoulder. Beckham looked to the cockpit where Liam was still going over the controls while stroking his bony chin.
We good? Beckham asked.
I think so, but you better all hold on to something, Liam replied. This is going to be a rocky ride.
Before we get into the air, put one of these on, Rico said. She held up a CBRN suit to Liam.
You won't have a chance if you're flying.
Liam waved the suit away.
I'm not going to live long enough for it to matter anyways. And if we're going in dark, I can't wear night vision goggles with that.
Rico held the suit back.
Seriously, I've got death inside me, Liam said. This is my last hurrah.
Beckham felt his heart crumble. This man was the best of humanity, in a time where the best were needed more than ever. It was a rough liftoff, but Liam got them in the air. Beckham looked over at something else humanity desperately needed. Marines. The five brave warriors were no longer in the fight. 17. Dripping water echoed throughout the webbing-covered tunnel. Kate listened for the telltale scrapes of claws against walls or the rasping growls of a stalking variant under the hum of the generator. Floodlights illuminated their rudimentary workspace, casting the tunnel in a brackish glow. The light reflected off the thin layer of water rising just under their ankles, water from a broken main. Her team was spread between heavy black folding tables like those command used in their forward operating bases. Ron, Leslie, and Sammy each wore splash suits and respirators to protect themselves from any potential contaminants, which was even more important with the dirty water. The more she listened to the creaks and groans of the tunnel, the more every creeping sound reminded her of clicking variant joints. Every shadow seemed to move, like a monster preparing to strike. Even with the four outpost soldiers holding security, she couldn't shake the uneasy feeling.
This place was frightening enough on its own to inspire nightmares. She shook away her fear and pictured the hope she'd witnessed with President Ringgold's arrival. Sure, there were people who didn't want her here, people who blamed her for the new war. But most were just glad to have their president with them.
"Sammy, get the computer set up," Kate said. "Ron, Leslie, hook up the microelectric arrays to the webbing. This time we won't be gating them."
The lab tech started opening the packs and boxes they brought. Sammy slipped a pair of laptops from her pack and placed them on a table. Sweat trickled down Kate's nose as she worked. She resisted the urge to lift her mask and wipe it away. Instead, she checked her wrist monitor. The temperature was nearly 90 degrees. Sergeant Wynn, the outpost soldier leading the escort team, saw her glancing at her monitor.
"Why is this so damn hot?"
"The webbing," Kate said. "It has a very high metabolism. It's kind of like a warm-blooded animal producing body heat."
"So this shit is living?"
"Absolutely. It burns through a ton of calories to produce that kind of heat and keep itself nourished."
Wynn tilted his mask at the wall to examine the webbing.
"That means the damn stuff needs a lot of us to keep it fed."
Kate nodded.
"Aside from us, they eat every animal the variants can find. Even bugs are absorbed." "Connections are ready," Leslie said.
Ron traced a network cable over the tables. The cable connected to a microelectric array clamped to a segment of webbing. He handed the end of the cable to Sammy, and she plugged it into her computer.
"I think we're ready to go."
Sammy stood at a table as Kate joined her.
"Just give me the word and I'll tap us in."
"We can decode everything, right?" Kate asked.
"The code worked on all the signals we recorded before, so unless the variants and collaborators are using new modes of communications, we should be good, but..."
"It's okay," Kate said. "You can do this. Decode the signals, and if it actually works, we can move on to trying to communicate with them." Sammy had promised Kate she wouldn't make a mistake again, and now Kate could tell she was nervous.
"I need to sit," Sammy said, gripping her side.
Ron set up a folding chair for Sammy, plopping it into the water. Sammy clutched her injury as Ron helped lower her into the chair. The way Sammy worked, Kate sometimes forgot it hadn't been that long since the engineer had taken a bullet to her abdomen. She was extremely